Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created man in His own image. In the image of God He created him. Male and female He created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for fruit food. And to all the beasts of the earth, and all the birds of the air, and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. And God saw all that He had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning, the sixth day. That reading is from the very first chapter of Genesis. And it sets the tone for all the rest of the Scriptures in terms of the view that is presented of half of the human race, the female gender. Because from the very beginning, God set forth the fact that whether male or female, we're all made in God's image. No distinction, no difference in that regard. And so everything that is involved in being made in God's image is true equally of both male and female. The intelligence, the love for beauty, the having a heart and mind and spirit, to a desire for eternity in our hearts, a place for God to live within those hearts. All of that is true. We'll just talk a little bit tonight about the role that women have in the Bible. I'm thinking about doing for the next few Sunday nights a little series of lessons on some of the extraordinary women of the Bible. Now, I'm not smart enough to have come up with that by myself. But one of my favorite biblical authors, that is a man who writes a lot of books on the Bible, recently came out with a book called 12 Extraordinary Women. I've just been fascinated by that book. Earlier, he had written another book called 12 Ordinary Men, which had to do with the apostles. But of course, there are no apostlesses. So instead, he looked through the Scriptures and tried to identify, in his book at least, of the many women that are found in the Bible, 12 that we have enough information about that he could write about them, and we can learn lessons from it. But just that whole concept of specifically noting that women play an important role throughout the Scriptures and God's plan is something that isn't always pointed out. In the ancient world, for example, women in most cultures held at best a subservient or second-level role. And in some cultures, they had no rights or privileges at all. It's amazing that among the early Greek philosophers, those that we often hold in such high esteem, you recognize her name, men like Socrates and Plato and so forth, their view of women was that they were by very nature inferior to men. Makes you sort of put a question mark next to anything else they say, too, as a result, if they weren't smart enough to figure that part out. But even in other cultures, we even see it in the Scriptures themselves, in some of those cultures that surrounded the ancient Hebrews, women were often a part of the religions of those other groups in which they were actively involved in prostitution, for example, as supposedly a way of worshiping the gods. And that wasn't because they were holding those women in such high regard, it's because they were seeing them basically as objects. Just like often today it's argued that women who are pressed into that kind of role in our culture are just seen rather as objects rather than as people. But not so in the Bible itself. Now, it may be true that in some parts of the Bible, they do not have necessarily the exact view of women we think we have of them. And yet, overall, in the Scriptures, women have a very high standing within the Scriptures. Their virtues are highlighted, their the importance of their influence and their culture and in the work that God was doing, and even specifically, of course, God using them in very special ways. Here in Genesis chapter 1, it sets the tone for all of that by saying they're created in God's image. And that's repeated later in the book of Genesis in chapter 5 when it's down to the account of the flood in Noah's time, when it said that when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female. At the time they were created, he blessed them and called them man. And so man there obviously is being used in the more generic, not the gender-specific way, but rather humankind. Male and female, all made in the image of God. And so from the very beginning, we see, for example, that Eve is a equal partner and a companion with Adam, for example. Even though Adam was made first, and it says afterwards that Eve was made to be a helper sufficient or a help mate for him, nevertheless, she very much has a very equal role along with him. She speaks, she influences Adam. When the sin is committed, God comes down and he has a discussion with both of them, and they both are held to blame for what happened. And what God pronounces happens after that is pronounced for both of them, not just for one or for the others. And Mount Sinai, when God was giving the Ten Commandments, interesting little piece here if you think about it, one of the Ten Commandments was that children were to honor their father and their mother. In many cultures, that was not necessarily required, but it was in God's culture. Commanded at Sinai is one of the Ten Commandments. It's true that in places like 1 Peter chapter 3, it says, as I think just a statement of what is generally recognized as fact, that women are the weaker, physically, vessel, or in generally speaking, women are smaller, lighter, built differently because they have different primary biological roles within humankind. But it has nothing to say about their mental or their spiritual or emotional strength. It's only speaking, I think, there of their physical. But on the other hand, in that same verse, it says, "Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives and treat them with respect as the weaker partner, and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers." Here in the New Testament, just like in the Old, women are held in high esteem. Christian men are being told that their prayers can be hindered when they pray to God if they don't treat their wives with respect, and if they don't treat them as heirs together and partners in their Christian life. Looking back in the Old Testament, I'm just glancing down through some of my notes here and thinking about some of these things. We often think about the beginning of the Jewish race as starting with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But it also started with Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel, and Leah. Because there wouldn't have been any beginning to the Jewish race without the ladies there right along with it. But more than just the fact that they were the mothers, Abraham's wife Sarah, Isaac's wife Rebekah, and Jacob's two wives, Leah and Rachel, not only were they the mothers of those the children that came, but they played very influential roles. When we actually were reading through Genesis, we saw that all of those women actively participated along with their husbands in what was going on, and they often spoke their mind and influence the outcome of what happened. Later, when they're brought out of Egypt, you know, they go down in the days of Jacob and his sons, they go down to Egypt, and then when they come out in Exodus, we focus first of all, of course, on Moses, but we need to remember his mother and his sister. Miriam, his sister, not only was there watching him while he as an infant is placed in the ark in the river and then is rescued by Pharaoh's daughter and her servants. But then his mother, whose name was what? Jochebed? Jochebed, then is called to be the nurse to raise this baby. And so the real mother becomes the surrogate mother of him as he grows up in Pharaoh's household. Consequently, over in the book of Hebrews in chapter 11 and about verse 23, she's indirectly mentioned as one of the great heroes of faith. Later, when they actually come out of Egypt under Moses, right there standing beside Moses is his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam. And when they cross the Red Sea, she composes a song about the victory and deliverance that God had given them from their enemies. And so in the book of Micah, written hundreds of years later, this prophet of God looks back at her and calls her, along with Moses and Aaron, as the leaders that God used to deliver his people out of Egypt. It's held in very high esteem through that story. And we get into the book of Judges. One of the early judges was a woman named Deborah. Judge didn't so much mean what judge today means to us, so much as it meant deliverer. I think she recognized the difficulty she would have, perhaps just as a woman by herself, doing that job as deliverer. And so she recruits a man to be her helper in that. And he becomes her general in fighting the battles that had to be fought to bring the victory, to bring the deliverance. That was Deborah. When they start into the land, the very first place, as we mentioned this morning, they faced to conquer once across the Jordan was Jericho. And who lived in Jericho but a woman by the name of Rahab, who operated an inn there. And when the spies had come in earlier to see what they were going to face when they got there, she had hidden them and protected them from the king of Jericho and his soldiers who were trying to seek them out and find them before they went back and reported to Joshua. Rahab ends up in the book of Heroes 2 in Hebrews 11. Not only that, she, along with the others we've mentioned, Sarah, Rebecca, and obviously Rachel, end up in the lineage of Jesus as well. God chose to single these women out and mention them specifically as being direct ancestors of Jesus himself. Once they're in the land, they're there for a while. Kind of hard to know exactly that some of the time frame of it, but it's getting down towards the end of the period of the judges. We had Deborah early, but then late we have this other very interesting story that takes place about a woman who, with her husband and two sons, has to leave the area around Bethlehem, and they went over into a foreign country. And while there, the two sons marry, but then the husband dies, and then the two sons dies, and the woman is left alone with her two daughters-in-law. And so this woman named Naomi decides she needs to go home, back to Bethlehem. And both of the daughter-in-laws initially say they'll go with her, but she convinces one of them finally to stay, but the other one will not be convinced. And she goes back with her mother-in-law. Her name was Ruth. When they get back to Bethlehem, eventually she meets a kinsman of Naomi's named Boaz, and they get married, and they have a son. His name was Obed, I believe. And Obed had a son named Jesse. And Jesse had a son named David, who became king of Israel, and who in the Old Testament, perhaps as much as anyone else ever mentioned in the Old Testament, is a type then of the Christ that would come. So again, a woman not only very prominent in a part of the story, but so prominent, in fact, that now, at least in our English Bibles, one whole book of the Old Testament bears her name. So it should come to mind at that point. We remember there's another book in the Old Testament named after a woman, too. We have to move forward in time about 500 years, but we have another book named Esther, after another Jewish woman who played a very prominent role in God's history for his people and God's purpose being accomplished through them. I run across this little story in 1 Kings when Solomon first became king. I think we see something of the respect that he treated his mother with. You might remember that David we just talked about that was born as a great, great grandson or great-great-great-grandson of Ruth, that he committed sin with a woman named Bathsheba. But eventually, you know, that was straightened up with God as much as that could be straightened up. And even though the child that was at first conceived out of that relationship died, later another child was born. His name was Solomon. And when he becomes king, after his father passes away, his mother, Bathsheba, is still alive. And he had an older brother named Adonijah. Even though David had picked out Solomon to be his replacement, his heir on the throne, Adonijah also wanted to be king. And he'd come around and persuaded his mother to go talk to his brother about a wife. Well, it wasn't for nothing that Solomon was called the wisest man who ever lived. Once this all comes to Solomon, he realizes what his brother's really trying to do. But we'll just have to sort of lay that aside for the time being. But I do want us to listen to what Solomon does when his mother comes in to see him. Now, he's sitting on the throne. He's the king. But it says in 1 Kings chapter 2, and in verse 19, that when Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak to him for Adonijah, the king stood up to meet her, bowed down to her, and then sat down on his throne. And he had another throne brought for the king's mother, and she sat down at his right hand. Now that's treating your mom with some respect, even if you're the king. When she comes in, he bows down to her, gives her the respect that she's due. Again, it's just illustrations of the fact that through the Scriptures, along with the teachings or the examples, how women were so often treated with the kind of respect that they ought to be treated with. When the law was given in Exodus and repeated parts of it in Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, when they were told to observe the feast, when they were told to participate in the worship that would take place around the tabernacle, it was male and female. Women were not excluded. Now, true, the priests were all male. God had specified that. But in terms of the worship, in terms of the sacrifices, in terms of all the other things, men and women were on an equal basis before God. In the law, they were allowed to own property. They were business people along with the men. In fact, we have a couple of references in the Proverbs, which were mostly written by that wise man Solomon we mentioned, in which references to their business dealings, though women, was something that was noteworthy. In the 14th chapter of Proverbs, it says in verse 1, "The wise woman builds her house, but with her own hands a foolish one tears hers down." Now, of course, the emphasis there isn't on business. The emphasis is on the difference between someone acting wisely and someone acting foolishly. But he just calls up this illustration of a woman who, in wisdom, builds her house. But the greatest reference to that is in the last chapter of Proverbs, in Proverbs 31, where he describes what is called a wife of noble character. Sometimes wonder if Solomon, if he did write this section, wasn't thinking of his own mother in some ways. For it says in Proverbs 31 and 10, "A wife of noble character, who can find? She is worth far more than rubies. Her husband has full confidence in her and lacks nothing of value. She brings him good, not harm, all the days of her life. She selects wool and flax and works with eager hands. She is like the merchant ships, bringing her food from afar. She gets up while it is still dark. She provides food for her family and portions for her servant girls. She considers a field and buys it. Out of her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her task. She sees that her trading is profitable and her lamp does not go out at night. In her hand she holds the distaff and grasps the spindle with her fingers. And she opens her arms to the poor and extends her hands to the needy. And when it snows, she has no fear for her household, for all of them are clothed in scarlet." Certainly it's describing a woman here who is a business person, along with a mother and a wife. And that's held up as something praiseworthy and honorable. And again, that's in contrast to many other cultures during the Old Testament, New Testament times in which women could own neither property nor run businesses because they were not considered on an equality with men. When we get to the New Testament, the picture's even better because it seems like almost from the very beginning, Jesus, shall we say, recruited women to be His disciples right along with men. It's something extremely rare, even among the Hebrews. So I've read that when the rabbis were calling their disciples, it's almost unheard of that it would ever be women. And yet for Jesus, it always was. Women and men. When He was teaching, it was women and men. As we were talking about this morning, when He was going sometimes into households, He went into the home of Mary and Martha on several different occasions. We have that record. He saw them as disciples of His. He even told them that following Him as a disciple was even more important than them doing a good job at their household responsibilities. They followed Him. They supported Him. They were there at His crucifixion. They were there at His resurrection. And in fact, He made sure, so it seems at least, that the very first ones to know that He was alive and to see Him alive were the women. That would be a very, in very stark contrast to what might be true if the story was not written by God, if it was just followed the cultures of their day. Jesus didn't just treat those who were disciples of His with great respect. Women are spoken of with great respect in the stories He tells. His mother is treated with great respect when she's mentioned and when He interacts with her. Even when He meets women from other cultures, like in John chapter 4, He meets the Samaritan woman. He sits down and has a conversation with her, a spiritual conversation that ends up not only leading her to faith in Him, but by her going back to her village and telling others what He had said and them coming out, they are led to faith as well. Later, He will have a conversation with a Canaanite woman who comes to Him. She's heard that He can do miracles, and she has apparently a child that is ill, so she seeks Him out and asks Him for healing for her child. And Jesus at first says that He was sent to the lost sheep of Israel, or words to that effect anyway, that you know that was what He was first sent to, the children of God in Israel. And she says, yes, but even the little dogs of the children get some of the scraps that fall off the table. And He was greatly impressed with that kind of faith. And so even from a long distance, He healed her child. This is the kind of picture we're seeing in the New Testament, just like in the Old Testament of women, that even though they might not have leadership roles in some ways, they were a vital part of the ministry of Jesus, the outreach of Jesus, and then in the early church, in the book of Acts and following, we find them very much a part of things. In Acts chapter 1, when the apostles and the other disciples are gathered there in Jerusalem waiting for the coming of the Holy Spirit, among them are the women. They're there too. Some things are, you know, they're mentioned in various and sundry ways in throughout the book of Acts. There was the one lady who had died, and I think her name was Dorcas, that had dedicated herself to making clothing for those who were less fortunate. Now she had died, and the apostles are called, and she's actually raised from the dead. Other stories like that as well. When we get into the epistles, particularly, we hear Paul often giving salutations or greetings to women in the various churches. He mentions, or it is mentioned at least, that one of his co-workers during the book of Acts was a woman by the name of Priscilla or Prisca. Often, in fact, maybe every time she's mentioned before her husband, which is often taken to mean that probably she was even more active in this work along with Paul than her husband was, or at least she took a more leading role in that particular way. At the end of the book of Philippians, he mentions a couple of other women that he refers to as his co-workers, his fellow workers in the gospel. Philippians 4 and verse 2 and 3, I plead with Euodia and I plead with Syntyche. Those are women's names. To agree with each other in the Lord. Yes, and I ask you, loyal yoke fellow, help these women who have contended at my side in the cause of the gospel, along with Clement and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. What we're just seeing here is that these women are mentioned right along with men as co-workers with Paul. They helped spread the gospel. They were supportive in the things that accompanied that. When we get to the end of the book of Romans, just woman after woman is named. Not only Priscilla, we've mentioned before, but numerous others in there. Priscilla, here's Mary, I think Ampliatus, I think that's a woman's name. Several others that are named there that, verse 12, Persis, another woman, he says, who has worked very hard in the Lord. And then greet Rufus, chosen in the Lord, and his mother, who has been a mother to me also. And so Paul, who sometimes by very liberal scholars seem to be accused of being a male chauvinist, doesn't quite live up to those charges. He often names women as being fellow workers with him. He even tells Timothy that he needs to follow in the teaching of his mother and his grandmother, who had taught him from a child the scriptures. And that had ultimately led not only to him becoming a believer, but now a minister of the gospel along with the Apostle Paul. I'll just mention all those almost in passing in some ways to say that, you know, as we spend a few weeks talking about some of the more outstanding women in the Bible, outstanding from the standpoint that we hear of some prominent role they had for good in the Scriptures, we just want to acknowledge that that's the standard in the Scriptures, not the exception. And it really should always be the standard that the church is called to in the present age and in every age, to recognize that we've all been made in the image of God. We're all equal before Him. Galatians 3, 26 and 27 says, in Christ there's neither Jew nor Greek, bond nor free, male or female, but we're all one in Christ Jesus. Just like it would be wrong for us to be racist in the church, are socially stratified, as much as we could prevent that in the church, then we also should not be gender specific in some way in the church as well, in regard to the unity that we have and the recognition we have of each other's proper place in God's plan for things.